This spoiler-filled podcast is recorded live, unscripted, and intended for those over 18. Now prepare your ears for the audio stimulation they've been waiting for all day as we step into
the spoiler room.
And here we are in another episode of the Spoiler Room. Yes, folks, you're getting lots of Spoiler Room because there's lots of great movies to talk about. And tonight we're going to talk about three movies from the past, the first three Mad Max films in honor of Mad Max Fury Road coming out tomorrow in many, many theaters and nationwide on Friday. And tonight I have a great group of Spoiler Room crew members in here with me. Tonight, once again, we have Mr. Cole Meredith. How are you, sir?
Terrific. Thanks for having me, man. I'm stoked about the show, for sure.
You bet, definitely. And the BFD himself has returned once again, Mr. Glenn Bittner. Hello, sir.
Call me the Night Rider. Think of me when you look at the night sky.
Night Rider! Night Rider!
you just need, what is it, a hot redhead on your arm and you're all good. And driving
Glenn,
100 miles an hour.
Glenn, you are a fuel-injected suicide machine, man.
Yes, you are. And then we have the Raggedy Man himself, Mr. Scott Davis. How are you, sir?
I have no name.
You have
I'm doing okay, man.
And it is I, your host, the Mark the Toe Cutter Movie Man himself. And tonight we are talking the first three Mad Max films. So we're going to dive right into this. To the first film of the trilogy, aptly named Mad Max. Now, Mad Max is set in the near future, which I love because we never get a date. Let's start right off with this film. They don't give this film a date of how far into the future it goes, just a few years, right?
Which is
a few years from now.
Which is brilliant because I don't know why so many films, I mean, I get why the old films from like the 50s and 60s did it. You know, it's like future. Once it became clear that, oh shit, movies are going to be around for a while, I don't get why people put a year on things because it immediately dates the movie. You know, so we always have to kind of disregard when we see 1990, The Bronx Warriors, or the year at the beginning of Escape from New York, or even Thundar the Barbarian, where apparently we're like we should have had like a comet destroy us like about 21 years ago.
Yeah, man, that is a great point. Imagine watching Escape from New York without the year pasted to it.
Yeah. I mean, as long as you hear, like, a few years from now, that's all you need to know. It's like, okay, it's the future. Things have gone to hell. That's all you need to know.
Well, I thought it was brilliant as well. Wouldn't you agree, Glenn? Because it doesn't, as Scott said, doesn't date the film. You could have this take place anytime from when you're watching it on, right?
Kind of.
Well, except for maybe the fashion and the cars, but...
I don't know. That thing's never really bothered me because of the fact that at a point, any movie's going to seem dated. Doesn't matter how, I mean, provided we don't kill ourselves off, there's going to come a point when, you know, people in, like, you know, 24, 50, you know, man, Star Trek, were they way off? You know? So...
We haven't even found Mars yet, man, and they were way
I like it at times when they do it because when you look at when a film was made, it shows the kind of, you know, the thoughts of the fact that people in the 60s and 70s and even the 50s, they'd be a fucking amazed we're still here. You know, I'm thinking anyone over the age of 60, every day is like, well, we haven't blown ourselves up yet. I hadn't planned for this.
Good job on you, right?
I love it. It's like mild disappointment. the planet's still here.
So we start a few years into the future, which doesn't look very pretty. And here we have the story of an Australian policeman who goes out to avenge his partner being horribly mutilated, and the death of his wife and infant son at the hands
Wrong.
Of... Well, infant daughter?
His wife doesn't die.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry, you're right. She didn't die.
She just left crippled, and he abandons her in the hospital.
That's right! You're totally right. I apologize. She doesn't die. I was thinking she was left for dead. They were talking about salvaging, pulling parts off of her. So I kind of took it as her being dead.
I think it's left,
brain
it's
dead,
left
but
really vague.
I think that she is. I mean, I think it's kind of like maybe not a situation like the goose, because remember the goose doesn't die either.
Yeah, he's
no. He's just left in a little burn tent.
And I assume that it's similar to her, except with treads.
Well, and missing body parts, if you notice, because she's missing an arm. At least, or a leg, because she doesn't have all her parts on the bed. You can tell that.
Yes. Yeah, she won't be able to sign to him anymore, yeah.
And wow, you are a cruel bastard, Scott. She can't clap. She can't clap anymore either.
Awesome! Wow.
Her career as a saxophonist is gone.
I know, right?
Maybe play the piccolo. Possibly with support. But yes, okay, she doesn't die, but she's horribly mutilated. His partner is completely burned, like over all of his body, and his infant son got met the Goodyear man. So or the Michelin man, either one. Anyway,
actually, I think those tires from it. No, I'm kidding.
Anyway, he goes mad and goes after the motorcycle gang, abandoning whatever oath these police took, which I don't think is much, and going after them in a badass car. And that's it's not a very deep plot by any means, but it's the execution, at least, that stuck with me for this film. Let's start with you, Glenn. Would you say Miller's direction of this film really helps, I think, put it above some of the other films that had come out around that time of a similar theme, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think so. I think I've been reading a lot of stuff about these movies over the last couple, like week and a half, because now people, a lot of millennials are like, I just saw Mad Max for the first time and it was stupid. So,
yeah. Oh, fucking millennials.
I think part of the problem is that you have a film like this, you have to take it in the context of when it was made,
mm-hmm.
as well as where.
Right.
And anyone who watches these a movie like this and doesn't get it, I think the first thing you need to do is you need to check out, it's called Not Quite Hollywood.
Yes.
It's the wild and something history of Ozploitation. Because this is an Ozploitation film.
Yes.
The whole, Australia did these types of movies that was, it was them breaking out, doing their own kind of action-y and revenge-type films, And this film is pretty brutal in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
There are scenes that I don't know. It'd be the rare studio that would greenlight a gang rape scene.
Yeah.
Nowadays. And then you pretty much have that in this. But yeah, the direction, I think direction, because there are some parts of the script that I will agree with one of the reviews I read where I'm like, I'm not quite sure what, so you got the guy who's just, he and his girlfriend were just gang raped by a bunch of bikers, and he's running away with, like, blood coming out of his butt, pretty much, I believe,
yeah.
as he's running away, and Goose is just like, hey, fella, hey, you're a turkey. I'm like, what? What is, so aside from some little quips with the script, I think it starts with a good slow burn. You don't go into a lot of the specifics of why the world is the way it is.
Right.
Which I liked. Yeah. And I think that's good because I don't think it's necessary. You kind of start going. It's like, okay. I mean, you have to accept the fact that, so there's like a fuel crisis, but there's roving gangs just driving everywhere all the time. So I don't know where they're getting all that fuel from in the fuel crisis, but I try not to think too much about that because it's a good revenge flick and you got some cool cars and some good little chase scenes. So, and I mean, I kind of think, of where this was made, when it was made. I don't even know what the budget for this was, but
like 400,000, I think.
According to IMDb, estimated 650,000, and most of that was probably on stunts.
Okay, now I'm seeing. Yeah. Never mind. I'm looking at Mad Max. I'm looking at Road Warrior. Never mind.
I was gonna say we'll get to Road Warrior, but
I think he did for what he had to work with. I think he did a really really good job.
Yeah, I will agree. What about you, Cole? Did you like the direction of George Miller in this? Do you think that helped really make this from going to a kind of obscure odd film to really becoming the film that it is?
Yeah, man. George Miller, I mean, he, what really saves a movie like this, although there weren't many movies like this when it came out, you know, but what saves a movie like this is directorial flourishes, man. You know, how you can take, in this case, a low budget and a simple idea and really make it unique. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's where low budget films have a chance to shine, is you can do shit like that, you know, and really just do crazy unique things with a desolate location and maybe not a whole lot of people looking over your shoulder when you perform stunts. I really, you know, I realized watching this last night, I hadn't seen this since I started making movies at 24.
Oh,
and
wow.
It had been a long time. I've always owned it, but I watched Road Warrior and Beyond Thunderdome probably 100 times before I ever saw this, because growing up, this is, you know, obviously prior to the internet, and where I grew up in Evansville, Wisconsin, we just had a little video station attached to a liquor store that was called the Party Port, and for whatever reason, they didn't have the first movie. So it wasn't until years later that Hometown Video opened up with all of their bells and whistles and put the littler video station out of business, obviously, but they had everything, and I was able to take it home and see it and didn't enjoy it as much. Obviously, you can imagine having watched Road Warrior and Beyond Thunderdome 100 times, and then watching this as a kid in southern Wisconsin, you know, you're going to be like, well, that's not nearly as good. Now, having watched it, realizing I thought the budget was $400,000, but still, I mean, still with this new info, I mean, that's a huge feat to accomplish with that kind of money, what he did. You could pick it apart because it doesn't really seem post-apocalyptic in some areas, but that's just, we're nitpicking. I mean, this is low-budget filmmaking at its absolute best.
But see,
really, really good stuff. My only complaint is, honestly, and, you know, even understanding that they had no money and even understanding the climate in which this movie was made, the setup for his family's death is so long. It is for so many scenes, dude. And then the payoff is exponentially short in comparison. The revenge section of this movie is really brief.
Mm-hmm.
So it still bugs me. It bugged me as a kid, and it bugged me watching it again twice yesterday. Mm-hmm. I think the revenge section of this movie is really quick. And it there's an awful lot of, I mean, I don't think there's this much bait and prey in any Friday the 13th movie. I mean, that's my only complaint. But it's a magnificent low-budget film, really.
Yes. And Scott, what about you for his direction, George Miller? You think he was able to make a mountain out of a molehill?
Yeah, I mean, seconding Glenn's recommendation for people to watch Not Quite Hollywood, I think at one point, it might even be in the trailer, at one point in the movie, though, for sure, Quentin Tarantino says the Australians had a way of shooting car scenes that made you want to jerk off. And I'm not that much into cars, but it's true. You got to remember that, okay, this was an anomaly at the time. The only thing that was kind of similar to it was Death Race 2000 a few years before. But there were a lot of freaking car movies. You had Vanishing Point. You had Gone in 60 Seconds. Hey, Smokey and the Bandit. I mean, all these car movies. No car movie would put you in that action like this. And it's because they would shoot – and I was listening to the audio commentary earlier this week they would actually, like, put that camera, like, right on the ground. So instead of giving you, like, a safe distance away from the cars, they would put those cameras right on the ground or right up against, like, the car that was – whatever was traveling alongside them. And they would just roll it, and those other cars would come within like 6 inches of that camera, and they would undercrank it or whatever, and like to make it look like they were going any even faster. I think it was funny. They said, "Yeah, these cop cars actually couldn't go beyond 60." It's like, they said they couldn't go beyond 60, so we had to undercrank the camera all the time because to make it look like they went faster. Because was it undercrank or overcrank it to make it go faster? I don't know. Cole, you know more.
You run it slower.
Undercrank it. Okay, so undercrank it. I was correct. Okay, to make it look like it goes faster because they said it just wasn't. They just wouldn't go that fast. We had to give that illusion, but it puts you so in that moment. I mean, we even have cartoony moments, like where before two of the characters crash, and it is definitely a recall. Knight Rider, and then finally the big guy. You see that almost cartoonish thing of their eyes like popping out of their head.
I love that.
Yeah, it is completely unrealistic, but you know what? It puts you in that moment, and it makes it seem like such an intense, terror-filled moment. I actually love.
I'm sorry, Scott. I never didn't know you've ever been in a head-on collision. Maybe that's exactly what happened.
I don't know. You know what? No one was hanging out with a camera. That's for sure. But here's the thing: is that this movie I think is actually very brilliant, and I'm one of the few, because I know a lot of people they consider it kind of the lesser of the series. I actually like it almost as much as the second one. I think it's really fascinating. What I think is really fascinating about it is that it's definitely disarming when you first see it, if you see these movies out of order.
Mm-hmm.
What you've got to remember is, like, when these movies take place, they did the brilliant thing of actually showing the de-evolution of a society on camera, and this takes place right as the world is going to hell. And then you have the next one that's like a few years afterwards, and then the one after that is after enough time has passed for generations to start growing up, not knowing anything else, and, you know, sand is sweeping over these roads and everything.
Yeah. I was going to bring that up, that I think it's funny. This suffers from what I call Evil Dead syndrome.
Yeah!
This suffers from Evil Dead syndrome, the whole trilogy, and let me know if I'm wrong or right, in that what people picture as a Mad Max film is actually Road Warrior.
Yes.
Yeah.
What if people actually watch this first Mad Max, and it didn't really click on me till I was watching. I marathoned them. If you watch them all back to back, and I watched them, like, no, it's Army of Darkness, Evil Dead syndrome, to where everybody equates the Ash character to the later films, but you look at him in the first film, he's not nearly as the sarcastic, quippy guy that, you know, and just like in this one, all the wild vehicles in that really are, that's from the second one, though everybody equates it with that. The first one, you're right, and that's what threw me, because it never really dawned on me when I was younger and watching it, is that we're watching it's civilization that has crumbled not many years from when the film's taken place. It's like it's crumbled just after, say, you're watching the film and it says a few years later. You're like in the time period where it starts to crumble, and we're seeing the effects just after it crumbles. But we don't get that explanation, which I love. And, you know, and I just loved it because there is some semblance of civilization yet. You know, you do still have people going out for ice cream. You still have businesses, but you do have these roving gangs, which this motorcycle gang, headed by Toe Cutter, who is an interesting head villain. What did you guys think of Toe Cutter? I liked him specifically for the fact of they gave him a little bit of a different personality. He gives commands in grunts and whistles. Scott, what'd you think of Toe Cutter as a villain?
I love him. I love him. I mean, sure. Anything you say.
Anything I say. What a wonderful philosophy you have.
I mean, it's beautiful. I love this guy. He is one of my favorite villains. Again, I got to tell you, note that I am so, like, thrilled to you know, see him on the screen and everything like that. I'm looking forward to seeing him again.
Yeah, he's same actor playing in the new one.
Yes, the new one. Oh my God.
Scott's very happy about
this. Oh, man. No, I love this guy. He is great. He is just a wonderful villain. He has this sway on his people that is great. I mean, it's just, when you look at it, it's really nothing more than a handful of punks.
Yeah.
And they're like these subhuman people who are just into like smashing and killing and everything like that. But he has like this little pull on them. Like when there's the scene where, the boy is left behind.
Oh, sure.
Johnny the boy is left behind,
and, oh, God, you got to help me. Which is the guy, the bleach blonde son of a bitch?
That would be, I think that's, what did they call him? I forgot his name, too. Yeah, the blonde-haired guy.
I always get him mixed up.
Spike. It's not Spike.
The guy
who looked like Spike.
I can't remember if it's like Mudguts or if it's one of the other guys or whatever.
I don't know.
Anyway, we're getting beyond it. But like, there's the time where he's not going to go back. And it's not to the point where like people won't question this guy, but they'll do it respectfully. He says, I'm not going back, not for him. And he says, but it's not for him. It's for me. You know, and then he goes back. I mean, I love that. He's got this wonderful sway for the people. This is a really fantastic villain. I'm going to have people like say no way, but as much as I love the Lord Humongous, this is my favorite villain of the trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
I love Toe Cutter. He is just great. So, yeah.
What about you, Glenn? Toe Cutter, did you like him as a villain?
Oh yeah, and absolute best reaction to having a shotgun pulled on you ever. When the grandma pulls a shotgun on, he's all like, like a drag queen. All of a sudden, he's just like, you know, that high pitched kind of squeal and shaking his hands and he's a great. I mean, and part of what I enjoy about this movie is that some of the guys, like Toe Cutter, the actors, they're so over the top.
Yeah,
they were all Shakespearean actors.
Yeah, and you watch this and you're like. It just gives it a little bit something extra because these are not rough and tumble guys. These were, you know, stage trained actors.
Yeah.
And watching like someone who, you know, probably, you know, a week earlier was performing Hamlet and all of a sudden he's, you know, Toe Cutter. It makes it that much better.
Definitely. I just got a kick out of it, and after watching it again, I forgot about how he communicated with his guys occasionally, where he'd just make a grunt or a whistle or emotion. He didn't really use words, and everybody's like, "Oh, okay, they knew exactly what he meant," which helped establish that they had been around him long enough, at least to understand him. Cole, what'd you think of Toe Cutter?
Great, yeah, great, man. A very, very interesting performance and character, and. I wish maybe his demise had been a little longer, you know.
There's just
not enough revenge stuff in here for me. These guys die way too quick, man. But you know, I like the performance so much, mm-hmm. and it's so creepy.
Yeah.
I can imagine. Sitting in a theater in 79 watching this and really thinking, holy shit, this is groundbreaking stuff. You know?
Well, yeah, especially when they pick the villains to be just a motorcycle gang. I always love that.
I love
that difference between where the bad guys all rode motorcycles and the cops and everybody drove muscle cars. I just loved that difference in them as well. I mean, you know, here we got characters even down to the vehicles they choose. And it makes sense, you know. And now let's talk about our quote-unquote cops.
The Bronze?
The Bronze. See, I really did it. this is what I think added to that feeling of we've just got civilization deteriorating, and you've got these guys just hanging on, because this really seemed like a group of just rogue guys who had a badge, but, you know, because we know the law system is corrupt with that one scene with the guy getting off because nobody showed up at court. And you get these guys who are supposed to be cops, but I don't know. There wasn't much difference between them and Toe Cutter's gang, was there, outside of they didn't rape people.
It's the idea. It's the ideas. I mean, that's what Max is concerned about. And he, at one point, he wants to turn in his badge and live a life with his wife, because he says, I'm starting to enjoy this. He says, I spend any more time on that road and I become one of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's these people, and you know, it's again with society in on the brink of collapse, like in the process. Yeah. It's no accident that this weird, strange castle that it looks like they operate out of is actually like a sewage treatment plant.
Yeah.
That's not an accident. I mean, that's like basically the respect that the police get at this point, and it's as much as they're holding it together. And, you know, as they get more, as things get scarier and they get more frustrated, they start using heavier tactics and heavier tactics. And still, like, getting – I mean, you can actually see that reflected in other places, you know?
Sure. The Hall of Justice.
Hall of Justice, yeah. Superman blew away a long time ago.
Hall of Justice needs a few repairs. Cole, what do you think of our police force in this that Mad Max is a part of? These guys really, you know – what did you think of them? I mean, they really didn't.
I thought, you know, it's interesting, like you said, Mark, watching these back to back is an interesting experience overall as a film watcher. But what stood out to me is the tone those officers set in that first movie, specifically when one of the guys sees his buddy perhaps fatally injured, although the guy survives, with the glass in his throat.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah. He survived because he's talking later with the...
He's on the mic and he says, right. Yeah, you might want to send a meat wagon. Looks like this guy's about done.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's an ambulance, though. That's an ambulance they're talking about.
No, I know. It's just the indifference towards violence that mm-hmm. these cops express. Actually, the our lead character carries... through most of the series, I see echoes of the mentality, this specific police force's mentality, in his character right up to the end of Beyond Thunderdome. That's mm-hmm. what I noticed about it. Just watching him back to back is like we're in the midst of a corrupt police force, not because they're inherently corrupt, but just because what do they have to work with? You know, as you guys said, the Hall of Justice's sign is falling apart, and there's a little bit of political intrigue with their bosses. Am I mistaken?
Yeah.
Which I like. They just kind of hint at it. They don't shove it down your throat, but the whole tone of this film is specifically vague, which is probably why it's lasted.
Yeah.
You know? Probably a good reason that, you know, that George Miller was like, we're not going to give it a year as Scott said, you know, yeah. We're not going to give it a specific date. It really more or less holds up. But to answer your question directly, I think it's very creepy and very appropriate. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are how cops would react. Like the guy running through the gorgeously filmed field with blood coming out of the rear end. And the one guy's like, hey, you gonna come back here or what?
Yeah, and then he did go after him. He just let him run. He's like, ass, forget it.
For some reason, and maybe this is just a sign of the times, but that seemed very realistic to me personally. Like, oh, yeah, you know what? That is the sign of a completely bankrupt society when a cop has that sort of reaction to that sort of violence. I actually thought that was very intriguing, you know, the indifference of these cops and the way they acted.
Take into account, too, their boss was a guy who spent most of his time in leather pants shirtless and was named Fifi.
I was going to talk about that. We'll get to that in just a second, some That's of the overtime. But what about these cops, Glenn? Did you feel they were kind of like the way they were because they got it at both ends, either from the law and from the society, which basically didn't give him any help.
Somewhat. I think it's the. Yeah, they're kind of a product of their environment.
Mm-hmm.
This is not, this is not, obviously, the world's gone a bit to shit already, or at least this part of Australia has. The guys they're dealing with, these are not, the fact that freaking Johnny the Boy isn't like a bloody pulpy mess when he is getting out of jail.
Yeah.
Shows that they still have some honor.
Mm-hmm.
To a point, towards the end where, of course, anything goes. But, I think it's more just the fact that, the stuff they face every day, it's going to wear on you a bit. And sure. you're going to get a bit rough and you're going to get a bit broken.
Yeah, definitely. This kind of felt like the police force from RoboCop.
I was gonna say that when you were talking about how blasé they are in regards to reacting to the deaths of people or how what they go through, like how they're kind of in that gallows humor thing. It is like RoboCop. I look at like the way they do gallows humor stuff type stuff where they're joking around, like how when the goose is joking about the guy who's trying to scream with his face ripped off, and he's like telling it as a standard story. I was going back to when I was in, I worked for a very brief period of time, and I almost did it as a career, and I stopped. I almost worked in television news. Let me tell you.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was a mistake. I haven't had a great job since then, but I'm still glad I never went back to it, honestly. That's the effect it had on me because one of the main things was that people got so jaded and built up such a tough skin. You have to in that business, because you're dealing with all these things. Let me tell you something. If you're talking about a place that deals with national news, every story that comes in about a school shooting, somebody being raped and tortured, about a serial killer, about war, all this stuff, there are people making jokes about it.
Yeah.
And it's not cool.
Mm-hmm.
There are people, and it's their way of dealing with it. I mean, I remember I started working there a few months after the Columbine shooting happened. So, sure. Of course, we're dealing with a long time ago. And they had a van out at Columbine High School. They'd sent one out, out of state into Columbine High School, and the students didn't want any part of them. They were throwing rocks at the news van.
Sure.
And I'd hear comments every day where people were joking about the kids at Columbine High School, and Levinson says, like, man, throwing rocks at us, fuck you. I wish they shot y'all,
Yeah.
Not cool. But that's the kind of thing that they felt that where they were positioned was people that were kind of like in between. Like they weren't a fan. Criminals weren't a big fan. Like the police force in this movie, criminals aren't a big fan of them, and everybody else. So their position in this position of this is their world.
Yeah.
All of their world is this, and they deal with it by joking around and being blasé about horrible, horrible, horrible things.
Yes,
you know, it's hard for me to watch this movie without being reminded of that chapter in my life because I was like, it's kind of like when so and so is
sure,
so
well. So the police force, they're getting at both ends. Kind of reminded us of the Detroit cops, at least for me. Now let's talk about a minute. Glenn mentioned their leader, the chaps man with the bling collar. There are a lot. Am I off? There are a lot of homoerotic or homosexual undertones in this film. Are there not?
More so in the second.
But in the first, it's there, isn't it? I mean, between the gang and even some of the police. Am I off on that, or are those there? I am off.
I actually hadn't noticed it as much in the first one, mm-hmm. just personally. But then again, I grew up with leather heroes. You know, my favorite film of all time is The Crow, which owes so much to Road Warrior. It's not even funny. But that aside, Blade. I remember Blade was a movie I loved as a teenager. Mm-hmm. My heroes always had, like, leather. So I didn't notice that specifically. But, of course, that element is there. I mean... Yeah. But these biker guys, they seem to be pansexual. Mm-hmm. I mean, they seem to just want to screw everything, period. I mean, mm-hmm. they really do. They seem like, in all these post-apocalyptic movies, I remember watching Book of Eli. Yes. The same thing. Every time a woman is alone, it's said and done that she's going to be gang raped.
And that's certainly something that all of the Road Warrior ripoffs, like from Italy and Spain and everything else, took advantage of. You know, if there was a woman alone in the wasteland, she was fair game for whatever the bad guys are.
The name of the game seems to be when society falls apart, it's sexual perversion rules mm-hmm. for these movies. Not so much in Beyond Thunderdome, but in the first two, for sure. I mean, when people have free reign, in the movies, it seems to be they're gonna screw everything.
It doesn't matter what it is. Would you agree with that, Glenn?
I think if this had been a movie made in Hollywood, then I would say that yes, this is the Top Gun of post-apocalyptic movies, and it is hugely homoerotic. However, having seen that it's in Australia, I think there's a couple things. One, I think there is a lot less of that insecurity in masculinity, and that, mm-hmm. I mean, you could have the butchest guy could wear a fucking dress down the street and no one would say a fucking word to him because it's like, whatever, he's doing what he wants to do. But I think also, now this is what I have read and what I have gleaned from the few friends I have from Australia, is that they're also a much less prudish country than the States are, and just much more, hey, sex is sex, we're gonna do it, and there's a hole there, I can put something in it. I think part of it is just it shows kind of a difference in
culture, the
culture a bit, mm-hmm. that they're just, I guess, not as conservative as we are.
Yeah.
Maybe part of that comes, from the having been a penal colony at one time.
Yeah, exactly. As I was
I mean, and the bikers too. I mean, figure a lot of the bikers in this movie are not actors.
Right.
They're actual biker gangs that Miller paid with beer.
Yeah, that's right.
Is that true?
Yes. A lot of the bikers are actually he hired biker gangs.
Oh my god, that's incredible.
And there's a bunch of people who got paid pretty much in beer.
Oh yeah, whenever you see like a party scene, all those people are like, or whatever they're tipping over from at the moment, that was their payment.
Yeah.
That's low budget filmmaking, man.
That's pretty awesome. Also, you got to think that there was also, I'd say it's much more so where it is flat out stated in The Road Warrior, but in this one there is a certain fetishism to leather. Now, I love I'm no slave to fashion at all. I'm like a t-shirt and jeans kind of guy. The only piece of clothing that I absolutely love is my black leather coat. But I mean, it's awesome. But there is a fetishism to it because you have like things like, the biker gangs, Hell's Angels stuff that came out. You also had stuff like Kenneth Anger's Scorpio Rising. Mm-hmm. You have things like bands like the Ramones and stuff like that. Like, yeah, but also a lot of the leather stuff that was adopted from punk bands in Europe came from fetish shops. Judas Priest, of course, was like the big leather heavy metal band. It didn't come out for until 10, 15 years that Rob Halford just flat out says, oh yeah, I'm gay. it's like, so, You know, so and yeah, all that leather stuff, yeah, that all came from like the leather bars and stuff.
Sure.
You know? And so it's always gone hand in hand, you know, of the leather and the fetishism of it. It's a very sexual fashion, and often it's often been eroticized, and it has often been homoeroticized over the decades, I'd say.
And that's why I just wanted to bring it up. I mean, those are kind of there, and I wanted to get everybody's opinion on that. Like I said, I had no problem with it, but it just kind of a vibe I got from it from when they had it. And so that's why I wanted to bring that up. And we'll just wrap up quick on Mad Max here because I want to get to the Road Warrior and the other two. You know, as far as performances go, love Toe Cutter, love everybody in it. And Mel Gibson is young in this movie, but
21, right?
I think so, yeah. I think he was like 20. I mean, he was really young, but I thought he played the Max character well for it. It almost felt like the role was kind of written for his type of guy, you know, his type of performance possibly, because he wasn't really pushed, I don't think, too much for his acting chops in this. What do you think real quick of Mad Max's performance? We'll start with Glenn, of Mel Gibson's performance being a young actor in a film like this.
Well, I mean, he wasn't even much of an actor at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're talking about a guy who the only reason he got cast is he went to support a buddy and had been in a bar fight the night before and was all beaten up.
I love that.
Casting director saw him and asked him to come back in 2 weeks because they were looking for freaks to cast. And then, of course, you know, he healed. And, you know, it's saying secured my masculinity, he was a good-looking man back then.
Oh, yeah.
And probably went on fewer, you know, anti-Semitic rants. Maybe, I don't know. and he came back and charmed them, and they had him read for Max, and then he got the role as Max. So, not the best acting ever.
Mm-hmm.
It's more staying around, look pensive a lot, which he did pretty well, and
yeah.
or sit in a car and look pensive. So he had that down pretty well.
Yes.
I think it's also, it's hard at times to gauge the acting in a film where the audio quality is really not that good.
Yeah, I noticed that as well.
And this film, I mean, you know, as it said, this movie was cobbled together. You know, this was Miller's first movie. I mean, fuck, I don't know if he actually became, you'd think he was a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he had a doctor. You know, yeah.
So, but I mean, for what the role was, I think he's fine. It's not like some amazing, like, you know, oh my God, he deserves an Oscar. But it's not like some of the stuff I've seen on Sci-Fi Channel, where I'm like, is that person alive? Because I don't know. I think it's not really acting. It's more just a death rattle.
Yeah. and he could drive a car, which the stunts in here are just phenomenal for a film of this budget. What'd you think of his performance, Cole? You think it did all right for especially one of his
Yeah, man,
stunts?
For 21. I mean, my first performance was at 25, and I'm about to post my first two movies on YouTube just because I'm five movies in, and it's like,
yay!
Why not, you know? Yeah,
sure.
But I did a performance at 25, which I stand by, you know. But for 21, I cannot imagine doing that kind of work. I really can't. He did a great job.
Yeah.
For a 21-year-old actor, when you put aside what he has become and when you just watch Mad Max at, say, 3:33 in the morning over a glass of wine, not that I've done that, he's fine.
Yeah.
Who else is going to do that kind of work?
And I mean,
from innocent to, complete kind of innocence. Not really, although they set him up to be a badass, and then he's kind of plays the whole thing innocent, and then he becomes badass. I don't know. I mean, he did fine. He's great.
Yeah.
He's fine.
And besides, people watch it for the car wrecks anyway.
yeah.
I think we'd be remiss if we didn't also mention for those of you who like the movie Saw,
Yeah.
It probably wouldn't exist if it wasn't
for Yeah, they rip this that off.
Well, they didn't rip it off. They credit the directors, because they're Aussies as well, the guys
who made it. I didn't realize that they had credited the final scene of this movie
as their inspiration for the first Saw movie.
Mark,
could I mention something really quickly?
Yeah, sure.
I just want to say the original language version that I watched probably contributes to why I enjoyed it much more than the dubbed version. Mm-hmm. If anybody listening to this podcast happens to, you know, have access to a version with the American voices over it, please don't watch it.
Yeah, well, that's how we grew up with it, too. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that, Cole, because that's what it was like the first thing I was going to say is that about the performances. It's like, I didn't get to see the performance until, like, about 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Because when we grew up, we got now – a little background for people. AIP handled the distribution in the United States, and Mad Max barely got released in the United States. It was a hit in Europe, hit in Australia, barely got released here because AIP was in its like death throes right at this point. And what they said is they took one look at the film, and they said, no one's going to understand what these Australians are saying. Dub everyone, including Mel Gibson.
Oh.
And the dub job is very cartoonish, and that's what we grew up with. And it would always irk me because you'd hear, you know, the great, you know, people don't believe in heroes anymore, and you'd hear it like with like this, people don't believe in heroes anymore. Like, it was like really bad. And then, like about, I think it was around the time that MGM released it on DVD.
Yep.
And get on the special edition, not even on the original edition, but on like a special anniversary edition or something, like a 30-year anniversary edition. We finally in this country got to hear that original soundtrack. It makes all the difference in the world. And you said like, oh my god, the acting is really good in this. You're talking about Mel Gibson. The reason I'm talking about this is because now you look at it and say, it's an iconic performance. He does not say a lot, but yeah, you know, neither did Clint Eastwood in some of those movies and stuff. And it is great because you see a guy at, you know, it's called Mad Max, not because he's already a little crazy at the beginning.
Right.
The great moment is that Knight Rider's been like plowing through his friends like nothing, you know, cutting through people in a stolen interceptor. Knight Rider in the beginning is driving the same car, not, you know, of course not the exact same because it blew, but the same car that he will be driving by the end. That's important.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And what happens is that at the very end they say, Max, we need you to come in here, and we've only seen this guy like his hands as he's greasing up, or him like putting on his shades and stuff, and he just bumps up against him. Mm-hmm. And right away, Knight Rider's like freaking out. Why? Because he just came into contact with someone crazier and more reckless than he is.
Yeah.
And you get this, and he doesn't have to like growl or like punch people out to do it. He just is that. And yet you also see, you know, kind of a more tender side of him. And this whole movie's about how that tender side kind of gets extinguished.
Well, yeah.
It's a wonderful performance. It's a wonderful performance, wonderful acting. The thing about this movie is that, you know, I was watching, I knew, like, okay, Fury Road's coming out. I should watch a couple of these again. And honestly, it was like 4 in the morning or something like that. I should be like, oh, I should be in bed, but I'm not tired yet. Mad Max, I'll just watch the first 10 minutes.
Yeah.
I really do. Nah. The second the credits come on, I love the credits and everything in this movie. I'm like hour and a half later, I'm just watching the end credits of this movie going, oh my god, I love this movie so much, I forget how much I love it all the time. It's great. It's an amazing film.
It's got great stunts, impressive for its budget, and yeah, it definitely set the tone for films like it, including the films in the series afterwards, for years to come when it comes to your apocalyptic type film, which again, the apocalypse in this one isn't quite stated, unlike our second one.
Make sure you join us for part 2 of our special 3-part
episode where we cover the original Mad Max trilogy, where we talk about The Road Warrior in part two, and then after that, part three, which is Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. You can catch all these on iTunes or at specialmarkproductions.com.